I'm going to speak about perhaps a different area of adverse events related to vaccine use, and that's the area of user error. My background is that I am a pharmacist, and for many years I've actually been involved with a reporting program, a voluntary practitioner reporting program, that for quite some time now has been operated jointly by the United States Pharmacopeia and our organization, the Institute for Safe Medication Practices. Both of us are private, nonprofit, public charities that work together on this program. And I also have the benefit of working with the Pennsylvania Patient Safety Reporting System, which also collects ours, and we receive all the medication-related events, including vaccines, from that program. USP also has a program known as MedMarks, which collects a large amount of data based on incident reports that are filed by hundreds of hospitals around the country. So there's a source of information there that we wanted you to know about, to be aware of. My own area of expertise is patient safety, as I said. We often do get the opportunity to respond almost as if it was similar to the National Transportation Safety Board after there has been a serious adverse event. So we do that quite a bit, as a matter of fact, and we've learned from those kinds of things as well. This is the USP, ISMP Medication Errors Reporting Program. One of the other things that we do is share all information with the Food and Drug Administration. So when these reports come in, and again, these are from practitioners, we have the opportunity to interact with them. We can get great details. The basis for the reporting is generally altruism, and they contact us. We have a reporting form, of course, on the web, but then many of our reports come to us through the email or telephone or some other mechanism for communicating with us. We automatically send all of these to the Food and Drug Administration's MedWatch program, and likewise, we have an agreement and using the Freedom of Information Act to be able to receive reports from FDA. And our input, therefore, is through these programs, and our output is to consumers, practitioners, regulatory authorities, and then the industry as well. And one of the things that we do is advocate for change. So whether it's at the FDA, they have a division of medication errors and technical support, for example, in the Office of Surveillance and Epidemiology, or whether it's with the industry, we will pick up the phone, we'll interact with them to try to make recommendations when it's a product-related error, and I have some examples of those that I'd like to show. I was also privileged to be a member of the Institute of Medicine Committee that provided the report Preventing Medication Errors. This was under the IOM's Committee on Quality of Healthcare in America. And this was a pretty robust report about this problem of medication errors and also vaccine-related errors. And it laid out a framework for making improvements that you know, I hope you'll take advantage of and take a look at, because it does relate to your field as well. So what I wanted to talk about today was look-alike and confusing labeling and packaging, look-alike and sound-alike names of products, non-uniform expiration dating on products. There's no standard, and that sometimes adds to confusion. Unclear communication, for example, coin names, some of the vaccine abbreviations, and then oral prescriptions that are transmitted and misheard or mistranscribed, and then also touch on some of the Drug Administration practices. So a lot of what we get, and obviously I only have some examples here, and I'm not, you know, I can't say that this is a problem with any one company for sure, with any one manufacturer, but it is widespread, and obviously not just with vaccine products, with medications in general. We do have problems sometimes where there is ambiguous labeling or confusing labeling. And these products, this is the former pediatric and adult version, but only the adult formulation actually had the labeling adult formulation. And so occasionally we would get people that didn't recognize this was the pediatric version, and these would get dispensed. And it was just a simple matter of making a change to put the words pediatric on the product to reduce the potential for error. We saw a very similar type of incident with the products diphtheria, tetanus, toxoids, and acellular pertussis vaccine adsorbed, and its counterpart, one for adults, of course, and then one for pediatric patients. And this went on quite some time, actually. We received a number of them. And I want to point out a very unusual, I'm not sure how much thought's been given to this, but for our part, most of the medications that are handled by practitioners, physicians, nurses, pharmacists, et cetera, you will always have the brand name of the product, Superior, and the non-proprietary name or the proper name underneath, and usually it's half the size half the font size. This is just the opposite. And I think what's happening here, especially with some of the multivalent vaccine products that we're seeing, this is true of biologicals in general, by the way, that people see perhaps the first few words in some cases, or only read partial information on the label. And unfortunately, this has, I believe, at least from the feedback we're getting from practitioners, has led to medication errors. And I realize there's a reverse order of the names. That doesn't really seem to matter. These still can get listed in text appendices, et cetera, or in computer systems, which is exactly what's happened, in the same order, even though they are different products. We had great help in this case from the manufacturer in solving this problem with new labeling, where they really do a great job with differentiating these products through color differentiation, and then again, also helping to helping practitioners by noting which one is for children and then which one is for adults. So we really appreciate the response that we got there. But I do think we need to look into this nomenclature system. This is another product-related error that we had. And CDC, as a matter of fact, published this, I believe, even more than once. We published it numerous times, where we had, it was almost like an outbreak of cases where patients, instead of getting purified protein derivative TB skin tests, they were getting intradermal injections of tetanus and diphtheria toxoid absorbed for adult use. And unfortunately, some of these looked to be positive reactions, and quite a few people wound up on prophylactic INH as a result of the mix-up. We think that this had something to do with the five tuberculin units and 5 milliliters, both being within a circle. Perhaps people saw five. I also think there's kind of an unusual color pattern that just didn't seem to stick in people's brains that I think also could lead to this type of an error. But it was quite frequent, and I'm sure you're aware of the cases that we had. So a couple of one of the major recommendations that we have that we've made with the manufacturers is that all manufacturers, and this is being done a lot with medications, have practitioner testing actually done on their product labeling or product labeling schemes, color coding schemes, et cetera. Get out there with the practitioners and have these products tested to try to really understand what they think, what they read, what they understand that product to be. And I think that would help tremendously to reduce the potential for error. We have seen this with trademarks and medication errors. The pharmaceutical industry, for example, will almost never come out with a new product without having practitioner testing of their name. And as a matter of fact, the Division of Medication Error and Technical Support, although they don't truly require this, they do that type of testing internally. And it would be unwise for a company, I think, to try to approach FDA with a new drug application or an ANDA without having it tested for that reason alone. The statement that I did want to share with you about, and I just perhaps is a little bit out of order, about the vaccine nomenclature and the brand name nomenclature actually is derived from a 1968 Federal Register publication. So I think it is time to take another look at that, especially with all these new biologicals, et cetera, coming out and multivalent vaccines. It makes a lot of sense to me to take another look at that. We've always had problems with look-alike labeling. One of the things we've recommended for practitioners, of course, when they do face a situation like this, and of course we're also trying to interact with the manufacturers to make changes, is that you know, they add auxiliary labels or literally take a pen and circle, this is for 13 years old and older, and this is for 6 months and older. And one of the things that we do at the ISMP is we publish a newsletter that goes to every hospital in the United States every 2 weeks, where we actually picture these and try to communicate this information. It also goes to over 12,000 community pharmacies. We also have almost 1.5 million nurses that get the nursing version of our newsletter, and where we carry this information. Here's just a couple of others, and these are, you know, different products, and here's one where they tried to differentiate it slightly with yellow color, but it really doesn't hold up in practice, and very easy to mix these products up. Then we have the drug nomenclature mix-ups. You know, there are multiple ones that we've had over the years. I just put a couple here. You know, varicella virus vaccine confused with varicella zoster immune globulin. I know CDC's had that problem. FDA has communicated with us about that as well. We've had a few publications, and, you know, unfortunately we have new practitioners coming in all the time, and so this is a tough one to avoid. And then pediatric strength diphtheria tetanus toxoid, DT, confused with adult strength. I'm sure you're familiar with these nomenclature issues, and many of the other ones that we have here. Some brand name mix-ups, Combivax, Recombivax, Candon, Cantil, Vantin. I don't have to read through these. I know that you're aware of them. But this is where I think the testing with practitioners can really be helpful. So we would urge that the organizations do that. And we have some unusual circumstances with the expiration dating. One of the Venice Pasteur vaccines, poliovirus vaccine, inactivated, had an expiration date of 06 March 04. And, you know, this might be the order that's used in another country, for example, but in the United States, we're maybe used to it a little different. And it was very hard to tell whether that was March 6, 2004 or March the 4th, 2006, which is obviously quite a difference with the biological. So one of the things we've really tried to push for within the FDA, at least, is some standard dating, you know, standard wet method for using expiration dates. Lots of other nomenclature issues with vaccine products and biological products. One weird one that we've had on occasion, although we don't see it as much anymore, is DTP. In some hospitals and clinics, a common acronym for Demerol, Phenergan, and Thorazine. And we've actually had mix-ups between the two that have been reported over the years. We've actually been collecting these reports for over 30 years. We started in the 1970s. As far as the vaccine abbreviations, we certainly understand the benefit of having vaccine abbreviations and a standard method for doing this, but just be aware that people do occasionally confuse the various vaccines. I'm sure you are aware of that. So I would always use some redundancy, especially in labeling or printed materials, journal articles, et cetera, and put the non-proprietary name along with the vaccine because you have enough space to do it there. Oral prescriptions, obviously, people mishear, they mistranscribe. In practice now, we're really pushing for practitioners to transcribe any oral order, but then read it back. And a lot of this happens in doctor's offices, obviously, where a vaccine might be communicated orally to office staff and then misheard. So really a safe practice would be to transcribe that and then read it back. But unfortunately, in practice, it doesn't happen as often as it needs to. So we do enforce this read back. And then also method for communicating numbers, rather than saying 16 and 60 or 14 and 40 or whatever the number is, the single digit is the safe way to do that. Lots of issues with drug administration practices. This is one that I think people find to be incredible, but on numerous occasions, we have had mix-ups in the emergency room refrigerator where somebody goes to get a vaccine product and picks up one of the neuromuscular blockers, often pancuronium. These are paralyzing agents. Unfortunately, the doses that are given are so small that we really haven't had a serious adverse effects, but it is something to take note of. And obviously with vaccine products, and so many patients may be getting them depending on the environment in which these are being administered, this can affect a large number of patients. And on occasion, we have had reports here in the United States as well as elsewhere of large numbers of patients. In this case, 71 school children mistakenly given insulin instead of BCG vaccine. So in storing these products, we advocate, obviously, for separation and bins and different layers on the shelf. The packaging changes that I talked about a little bit earlier, the auxiliary labels, et cetera, all can be applied to reduce the possibility of error. And then just like you've been reading and CDC's been so involved with the incidents in a couple of locations, at least around the country, in New York and in Nevada, southern Nevada, the issue of multiple dose vial contamination where syringes were reused and somewhat this seemed almost like I would assume it was reckless behavior without knowing the full story where this, at least in part, in some of these locations may have been done purposefully to save money on syringe costs. We have inadvertent reuse of syringes as well. We have inadvertent reuse of needles, as I'm sure you're all aware of. I've even seen somebody receive an injection on television of an influenza vaccine, and then the person that gave the vaccine turned to the next patient and used the same syringe and needle. You probably heard of that as well. We had a report up in our area as well where either syringes are reused, or in this case, they injected patients and drew up the next patient's dose with the same needle and then changed the needle. So there's all types of variations on this. And then there is occasionally the reckless behavior that we need to be aware of as well. In this particular case, I remember it was a physician who actually was diluting vaccine in order to save the cost on vaccine, and 649 children were given diluted vaccine by their pediatricians. So there's also risk management material that's available. You may be aware or may not be aware that every month the Food and Drug Administration publishes patient safety news. And when we receive reports, we share the medication-related medication errors with FDA. They often will take this material and make videos that are done on site. They're very sophisticated, and these are shared. You can share them with your staff. They can be downloaded. There's no charge, and we're happy to see you using it. But many people don't know about it. This one is the Adacel and Dapticel confusion. You will find them on both our website at ismp.org, as well as the Food and Drug Administration, fda.gov, Patient Safety News, it's called. We also have our own newsletters, which go out to practitioners, as I mentioned, the nursing, the acute care, one for consumers, and one for community pharmacists. And then finally, I wanted to acknowledge John Grabenstein, a colleague of mine, a pharmacist colleague of mine, who I've known for many years, and he's been a real advocate, obviously, a public health advocate. And in recent years, he joined the staff in Merck Research. John and I co-authored a chapter on biologicals and medication errors in the book Medication Errors. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I think we have time for a question or two, if there's anyone who wants to come up to the microphone. Yes.
Hi, Howard Backer from California Immunization Program. I guess this is for Michael Cohen and any of the others. Given the frequency of this, and I know that anybody in an immunization program here gets these calls routinely of a mistake made like that of confusing vaccines, I guess I'm a little not sure why FDA and even CDC don't take a more aggressive stance making sure that manufacturers don't come out with a product where there's confusion. I mean, where's the prevention in this up front, which is a very simple matter? The other thing you didn't mention are, you know, now the vials are often color-coded on the caps, but these caps are very deceptively colored, and we know that there's tons of people who are colorblind, and so we have medical assistants reaching for vials by the color of the cap and giving the wrong vaccine because there's so many color variations now.
I can comment on that. Actually, we're definitely with you on the need for the companies to improve their labeling and packaging. And it is absolutely true that some of these have unfortunately going on for more than just months, actually years of confusion between two products before the product actually gets changed. I think there has been a real push on patient safety over the last couple of years. In the past, we've always thought, well, it's the practitioner's responsibility to read the label, and we even teach them to read the label three times. And while that's absolutely true, it doesn't take into account confirmation bias, where you see what you think is what you want, not what's actually there. And I think I showed you some good examples of how easy that type of mix-up could be. And so as we've progressed over the years, and I'm sure CDC and absolutely the Food and Drug Administration are more interested in this than ever, we are learning that we can't just tell people to read labels. We have got to design products safely. And as far as the color-coded caps, absolutely that is a factor. We see it. Not only that, but sometimes the caps of the vials are popped off, the multi-dose vials for sure, and then you have no color differentiation at all. So that is another area that I think is important. And there are some schemes that could be used. That is a possibility, but it is not enough. As you said, somewhere between 10 and 20% of people are colorblind for certain colors. Thank you.
Yes, thank you for that question, and thank you all for attending this session. With regard to that last question, I think it is important for FDA to be involved, although it occurs to me that although CDC doesn't have any really strong leverage, this might be a topic that gets brought up as ACIP working groups form around anticipating new vaccines coming on the market, and at least the issue could be discussed with the manufacturer, although we couldn't direct them to do anything as FDA could do.